The actor, comedian and writer Nick Mohammed hasn't followed an obvious career path. His youthful obsessions included performing magic and playing the violin, followed by a first-class degree in geophysics. He even began a PhD in seismology before his love of comedy took him in a very different direction. He's ended up on the red carpet at the Emmys thanks to his role as Nate, the football coach in the much-acclaimed television series Ted Lasso. He's starred with David Schwimmer in the sitcom Intelligence, which he wrote and co-produced. For his live shows, he created the much-loved Mr. Swallow, a peevish and pedantic magician who's also attracted millions of views on social media. Nick, you've brought us a magical array of music today, including Copland, Beethoven, Dvorak, but we're going to start with Prokofiev. Why this?
I've chosen, can I just say as well, an absolute pleasure to be doing this, and it has been not just cathartic but joyful kind of going through my music collection at home, working out what I should choose, and obviously it felt like, how can you possibly narrow it down? But no, I have gone for Prokofiev, in particular his ballet score for Romeo and Juliet, which I just feel is so, I mean, it's so massive for one thing. I think in its entirety, it's probably nearing 2.5-3 hours worth of music or something. It's huge. His music is so varied in this. There's just so much drama, so much emotion. There are fight sequences, really action-packed. It feels quite filmic, actually. And in particular, that beautiful, really delicate theme, which I think you've first hear in Young Juliet. And it's so bittersweet because it's a really sweet, delicate tune when you first hear it. But then when it's played so boldly at the end and you just realise these poor children have taken their lives, and it's just, oh, it's gut-wrenching.
Let's hear this bit where he transforms the young Juliet into such a tragic as well as a beautiful figure.
Thank you.
The Young Juliet from Prokofiev's ballet score for Romeo and Juliet, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Ashkenazy. It's so wonderfully skittish, isn't it? You can almost see a young girl skipping, Nick.
It's so playful. There's a real innocence as well to it. I've played one of the suites in orchestras before, and as a string player, there's lots of bowed sections to Sonny Pizzicato. You know, there's a real frivolity and a lightness to it. When it first comes in on the flute or piccolo with a da 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 da, that, I think it's the semiquavers. It's a da 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 da. It's that that just gets me right in the heart. It's just
it's all filigree, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It must have taken him ages to score.
You were born, Nick Mohammed, in Leeds in 1980. What are your memories of growing up there?
I had a lovely childhood. My mum was a GP, so she worked long hours. My dad went between a few jobs but ended up being a solicitor. So, you know, it was just a quite ordinary suburban upbringing, really. In terms of their background, you know, my mum's Cypriot Greek and my dad's Indo-Caribbean, so he's from Trinidad. So I definitely remember times when my dad would play like calypso music and stuff in the car. And actually we were made to is a strong word, but we did have to sort of attend Greek school on a Saturday morning. And neither my sister or I were that taken by it, to be fair. So actually Greek music wasn't really a big kind of part of our life. You know, we would hear it at Greek weddings and stuff like that.
So how did you discover classical music?
A very wonderful family friend who wasn't my blood auntie, but we used to call her Auntie Brenda. She was big into classical music and still is. And actually, it's probably really through her that I was first introduced to listening to, you know, to Radio 3, but also having tapes and CDs of stuff. And my mum and dad were both into opera, which I'm still not really a huge fan of, actually. But, you know, just went to a very normal comprehensive school. You know, music wasn't at the forefront, and I learned piano sort of by ear, but I was taught violin and joined Horsforth Music Centre, which I think is still going at Horsforth School. So on a Saturday morning we'd learn violin in a group. There was a group of us who were like 8-9 years old, and then subsequently, once I became a teenager, started having private lessons once a week. But I really adored it, and I don't know what it was that drew me to the violin. I think it's its range, actually, the fact that you can get so many different qualities of sound from a single instrument and still love it. You know, I wish I had time to play more, and I wish I was a better player, frankly, because there's some beautiful things written for the violin.
I know the feeling.
But also, it's one of those instruments where, you know, it doesn't really sound that great until you pass grade 5, really.
Did you see much comedy on television, for example, when you were young?
Yeah, I did. I loved it. I certainly never thought I would go into it or that it was a possible career path. Maybe it's not still, I don't know. But the first things I remember really laughing at were reruns of Some Others Do Have 'Em. I used to love that. And, you know, I would say that there are probably influences in Mr. Swallow, the creation of Mr. Swallow being this quank sort of camp, sort of busybody, clumsy. There are always stunts in the show that I do that are probably a nod to Michael Crawford as Frank Spencer. But, all you know, I loved so much French and Saunders. I adored Vicar of Dibley. But, I, you know, even the older stuff, like Dad's Army would watch, Last of the Summer Wine. You know, there was relatively far less choice back then.
But you were also really interested in magic.
Well, magic, again, was something that I kind of got into at a young age. And I remember watching the Paul Daniels magic shows that were on during then, and I adored them. And I remember my sister got a magic set from our auntie Leah. I think my sister would have been 7 or 8 at the time, so I was young. I was like 4 or 5, but I loved it and effectively hijacked it as my own. And that was the sort of seed for all of the magic, really, that I then got into. And every Christmas or birthday, I would ask for like a magic book or a little magic set or a magic trick or something. And I still do. But I used to work as a close-up magician for a while, doing like hotels and restaurants and events when I was a student and so on. And I obviously don't do that anymore, but I still love it and I still love to read about it.
Did it make you popular at school, being able to do tricks?
Probably a bit of a defence mechanism. It was a sort of self-defence technique. You know, if you ever felt uncomfortable in the school playground, or that, not that I was bullied, but like, you know, just that idea that, oh, I could get out a deck of cards and actually probably buy myself a good 10 minutes with these people if I needed to. And that always was reassuring. You know, I've got a deck of cards in my rucksack now, even, just in case.
Your next music, I think, comes from Scheherazade.
It does, indeed, yeah. It's The Young Prince and the Young Princess. I remember hearing Scheherazade on the radio, 11 or 12 years old, and I loved that theme. I think I probably just started learning the violin, and that, which I obviously couldn't play, certainly couldn't play back then. And I just remember, oh, that's a beautiful, beautiful theme. And I loved the way it would come back sort of in between each of the movements, really.
And, of course, another great Russian score.
Well, quite, yes. And I also love, and I only relatively recently learned, that Rimsky-Korsakov was Stravinsky's tutor, music tutor, which you wouldn't necessarily think. But again, I love his orchestration. I know that Rimsky-Korsakov was a violinist, so he always wrote really passionately for violin, and you definitely hear it in Scheherazade. He always really gets the most out of all the effects that you can make on a violin. But again, it's such great storytelling music, this. There are so many different flavours to it, and there's a lovely, exciting ending. I've played it a couple of times in orchestras, and I think there's probably a reason why a lot of youth orchestras do it, because it's quite a show-stopping piece. So it's one of those where you sort of feel really satisfied by the end of it, and it sounds really good, but actually it was quite playable.
Thank you.
the first part of The Young Prince and Young Princess from Scheherazade, performed by Maria Larionov and the Seattle Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Gerard Schwartz. Nick, you went to Durham University to study geophysical sciences. Did you join the orchestra there?
I did, yes. Yeah. So it became a really big part of my sort of university life, really. You know, I met my wife through playing in the university orchestra.
What did she play?
Well, she's an amazing pianist, but she also played viola and violin. So she played viola in the orchestra. When I was in my final year, she had just started in her first year. It's lovely in a way. So we have all these concerts that we've played in together, lots of shared memories and shared experience through music. And even until relatively recently, if friends get married, we'll occasionally put together a quartet and play as a contribution to the wedding. But Durham, I think in my final year, I was playing in both the chamber orchestra and the symphony orchestra. And then I was conducting the Hill Orchestra, which is the non-audition orchestra, but was still really fun and really nice. Not that I was probably a good conductor, but I certainly had a good time.
Well, actually, in one of your early TV comedy sketches, you were a conductor, weren't you? Trying to coordinate the different sections of an orchestra with your baton.
Quite, yeah. I'm sure it's probably online somewhere, but it was very much taken from my experiences. Because it was non-audition, you just had this orchestra which was so oddly sized. There was sort of 16 flutes, hardly any bass. And every week it was slightly different as well. It was great. And we just had a good time and we certainly didn't take it very seriously.
Andrew Lloyd Webber saw that sketch, didn't he? And invited you round.
Oddly enough, he did. Well, I think actually it was someone from the Really Useful group, his company, who had seen me do it at a gig. And then they got in touch. This is going back a number of years now, but they got in touch saying, Andrew is doing one of his festivals where he tries out bits from his new musicals and it's on one of his estates. And they would love for you to open it with this sketch. But they said, because you're going to his house effectively, he likes to have seen everything before. So would you just come and perform it for him? And the premise of it is like I'm conducting an orchestra. So I'm kind of, there's various eye lines as if I'm looking at the different sections of an orchestra. And I remember getting taken to Covent Garden and they were like, he'll be down in a second. And he just kind of, I want to say he came and sat in a throne. He obviously didn't sit in the throne. He just sat on a chair. But in my head, it was the throne because I was a big fan of his. And I sort of pressed play on the CD player and did this skit. But it was just him laughing. So it's kind of quite off-putting. But yeah, bless him. He really liked it. And then I got to do it. They were trying out the music to Love Never Dies, the sequel to Phantom. And I was a big Phantom fan. And they had a Friday night show, basically, and it opened that. So yeah, it was a privilege to get to do that.
I think the next music comes from your days in the university orchestra.
It does. I remember, so every year you had to re-audition. And for my final year, the sight reading was this very piece that we're going to hear, which is the third movement of Sibelius' second symphony. It's the fast, it's the fast string bit. And I sort of bashed my way through it. And I actually thought I'd done all right. And then I remember the president of the orchestra at the time said, "Were you nervous?" And I was like, no, actually. I thought, anyway, I managed to get in by the skin of my teeth. And Sibelius too is just glorious.
And it has very much, doesn't it, a feeling of that northern landscape. And I think it's quite a patriotic piece in a way.
And it goes sort of from high to low very quickly. And I think that's to do with the scale and the bleakness of some of those big Finnish landscapes. But the ending is just phenomenal. The third and the fourth movements run into each other, but there's this glorious bit in the fourth movement where it just takes this really dark turn. And as a second violinist, which is what I was when I played it, it ends with about 4 minutes of just rising and falling D minor scales. But there's just this glorious moment on the last page where it's like the clouds part and it just becomes D major, and it just fills you with hope, and it's like the sun is just suddenly shining on everything, and it's just gorgeous. But yeah, this is the third movement, the audition. The
yeah, you were full of hope when you were auditioning with this music, weren't you?
Yeah, quite.
Thank you. The third movement from Sibelius' Symphony No. 2 in D major, performed by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. It's almost like a human heart muscle contracting and pulsing.
Just that going in from that third into that fourth movement, it's glorious. It feels like an engine revving, and then you're off into that finale. It's funny, that music just takes me straight back to when I was at Durham, actually. I love that piece.
Nick Mohammed, you joined the Cambridge Footlights. Did you have a happy time there?
Oh, just the best. So I had done my geophysics degree at Durham as an undergrad, and then I got this place at Cambridge to read. I think my official PhD title was Seismic Imaging of Faroese Basalt. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And actually, the way that Footlights runs is that every 2 weeks they put on these sketch shows and you can audition to be in it every 2 weeks. So there was a real outlet. If you had material, you just got to audition it. And then if they chose you, you got to be in it. And it's very much where Mr. Swallow was kind of born, was through Footlights. And we just had an absolute ball. And I think there's just something about that thing of knowing that there have been so many people in Footlights who have then gone on to do comedy as a career. And I remember in July, just before heading up to Edinburgh, walking away from the Bullard Laboratories, which is where I was doing all my research and so on, and looking back, and I had this really quite romantic moment where I just knew, I was like, I'm not going to be coming back. And I did go back because I had to finish. I had to complete. I ended up, I think, with an MPhil in the end. I had to do another year's worth of work, but I cut the PhD short, which was definitely the right call. But I still kind of love the subject matter. I'm still fascinated by it.
An American in Paris next.
Yes, I just love it. It's so sprightly. It puts such a spring in my step. It's so positive. It just has this energy to it. And again, I feel it's sort of storytelling music. You can just picture. He paints such like vivid colours in his music. And I think indeed, even in that opening, you hear the honking of those taxis and the in the brass. And you can never be in a bad mood if you listen to that piece of music. There's just something, it just really re-energises me. And I think Gershwin doubted some of his orchestration abilities. And I want to say that I don't think he even orchestrated his piano concerto, but I think this is one of the first of his works that he orchestrated, and it's phenomenal.
Thank you. the opening of An American in Paris, composed by George Gershwin and performed by the Hollywood Bowl Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Felix Slatkin. And you're quite right, Nick, he did score it himself.
Yeah, it's so carefree, isn't it? Just hearing that again. You can just imagine just sort of whistling it down the street.
Nick, let's talk about one of your enduring comedy creations. We've mentioned Mr. Swallow, but you've been playing him since 2010, haven't you?
Yeah, that was the first time I did an hour-long show in the character. The character slightly predates that in that, I mean, look, it's an impersonation of a school teacher, so I sort of been doing that voice since I was 14, 15. But that was the first time I did an hour at the fringe of that character. And I remember previous to that, I'd done multi-character shows, and you could sort of see people shifting in the audience thinking, oh no, I think it is this for an hour. Oh no. And I just love being Mr. Swallow. It just kind of gives me an outlet to be a bit more rambunctious, and it's not rude, but he's got no filter, really, and he's tactless and clumsy, and I hope that I'm not too similar to him, but actually, and, you know, it's based on a female teacher, an English teacher I had, and so, you know, it is kind of quite camp, but it's only because I'm pretending to be her, but it is what it is, and it's kind of gone through various guises as Mr. Swallow. You know, I think I started in 2010, that was a show where he was lecturing about how to improve your memory, but it was very clear that his memory was quite poor and kept on getting very easily distracted away from this lecture. But always the sting in the tail with Mr. Swallow is it turns out he can sort of do the thing that he says he can. So that would end with him memorising a deck of playing cards, which is something I still do occasionally when I do Mr. Swallow at events and so on. But yeah, I don't think I'll ever stop doing it, you know, even when I'm 80. Or I'd love to keep going with it.
Do you think Mr. Swallow's music list would be very different from yours for this programme?
Oh, gosh, yeah, he wouldn't have time for half of this. I mean, he would just be like, oh, no, it's too long, it's too loud. It's just, he'd find a reason to sort of dismiss everything. I actually don't really know what kind of music he probably only really likes listening to stuff that he's had some active involvement in. So either something that he's singing or playing. He's so self-obsessed.
And his Jurassic Park performance on 8 out of 10 Cats, that had millions of views on Facebook.
Yeah, so, well, the background to it is this idea that Mr. Swallow has put lyrics to film scores that summarise the plots of those films, and his one for Jurassic Park, you know, has lyrics such like, it's Jurassic Park, it's a massive park, what could possibly go wrong? And yeah, it was just one of those things where, look, I feel like I take undue credit for it. It's clearly as a result of John Williams' phenomenal music and, you know, the fact that that is already an earworm. So the fact that I've just casually put some pretty poor lyrics to it is a very small thing that I've done, but it does provoke a reaction. Like, people seem to enjoy it, and I would say it's the thing that probably follows me around the most, even, you know, after Ted Lasso, people want to talk about the Jurassic Park song.
Well, here's the original. Thank you. Isn't it funny, Nick, how some of the most memorable themes, as you just said, earworms, are incredibly simple. I mean, that's just a few notes. And da-da-dum, da-dee, da-da-dum, da-da-dum.
Oh.
I mean, you couldn't think of anything more simple, and yet it's so telling.
It's phenomenal. And John Williams is an absolute master of doing things like that. Just something really straightforward, but just it being incredibly powerful. And, you know, obviously, you look at Jaws even. Jaws is what? You know, I mean, that's phenomenally simple, but goodness me, so effective.
The Jurassic Park theme by John Williams, performed by the studio orchestra and conducted by the composer John Williams. Mr. Swallow has appeared as different characters in all his shows, drawing on your magic skills as Houdini, and he's even played Dracula. How did you fare in the escape from a padlocked water tank while handcuffed?
I remember after Dracula thinking, oh, what should Mr. Swallow kind of tackle next? And there was just something, I think, intrinsically funny about just putting a character like that in a genuine life-threatening situation. And so as soon as I kind of had the idea of, like, oh, well, maybe he should just do this biopic of Houdini and it should end with the water tank, it's not so much that a show then writes itself, but you do have this engine for a show. He can sort of dilly-dally around, oh, whether he's going to do it or not and worrying about it. And then finally kind of has to go ahead and do it. But it never became normal to do it. It was always quite terrifying every night. And look, there's obviously a lot of artistic license in it, and you rehearse it down to a T, and a lot of the struggle is choreographed, as you might imagine. But, you know, it's still dangerous to padlock yourself in a tank of water, and you still have to do quite a long breath hold, which takes time to sort of develop, and you don't want to suddenly get nervous once it's in front of people and think, oh no, I can't do this, and suddenly want to breathe but you're actually underwater. So it never became normal, but there was one time when I genuinely couldn't manage it and they had to get me out because something had basically caught that prevented the mechanics of it working. And it was fine, and we had to make an announcement after the show to explain that actually that's not how the show is meant to end. And but it was the next day, it was the show the next day, that it then became really nerve-wracking, because all that was going on in my head was, oh God, I don't want that to happen again.
How did you escape? I mean, how did they know that you were okay?
Well, during rehearsals, we had a really great escapology consultant, a guy called Danny Hunt, who I incidentally had known before from my Northern Magic Circle days. So we kind of choreographed a whole sequence. And even though you're handcuffed, there are certain things that you can still do that would suggest that you're in trouble. Because obviously what you don't want is that the moment it looks like you're struggling, for them to kind of break you out of there, because obviously some of the struggle is theatrical. So I think I had to cover my eyes with the palms of both my hands, and they knew then that I was in trouble. And that was something that I could do while still handcuffed as well. That was the key thing. So they knew that I was in trouble and needed to get out.
Well, Nick Mohammed, I think we should be very grateful we've still got you with us. And at the moment, you're in Christmas Carol-ish at Soho Place. How close is it to the Dickens story?
It follows Dickens' classic, but the twist on it is that Mr. Swallow is actually playing a mean version of Santa Claus, who cancels Christmas because of the mounting costs, and is then visited by three ghosts, his previous head elves, and they have to sort of make him see the error of his ways. So it's been an absolute joy, and it's all the same team of people who I've been working with for, God, 10 years now.
Do you love the adrenaline rush, if you like, of live comedy?
Always, yeah. I mean, it's the reason why I think I am constantly drawn to it. There is something, and don't get me wrong, it's thrilling to work in television and film even, but there is just something about the immediacy of the communication of an idea, particularly if it's something that you've written yourself, and an audience receiving that and you getting live feedback, basically. I don't know, it just gives you a buzz. And there's just something really quite frontline, I guess, and something quite pure about just standing on a stage doing your thing, your comedy. And, you know, people vote with their feet. You know, you're either funny or you're not. There's nowhere to hide, really. And I like that.
Beethoven 7 next, and under Carlos Kleiber.
Yes. So this particular recording is a CD that I've had from when I was 15, I think I got that. I remember I was doing GCSEs when I started to get into Beethoven. In those sort of formative years when you're growing up a little bit, that music just, it meant so much to me. And I remember Becca, my wife, told me about these transcripts of Beethoven symphonies for four hands on one piano. And when I proposed to Becca, and this is 10 years ago now, almost exactly 10 years ago, it was 13th of December that we got married. One of her favourite movements is the second movement of the Fifth Symphony, and it's the slow movement. And I thought, oh, well, maybe I can track down this music. So I tracked down this music and just about figured out my part on the piano. And so when I proposed, I actually presented just this music and I said, oh, let's just play this. I've been practicing it. And then on the last page, it said, would you marry me? So Beethoven, the symphonic works of Beethoven, just feel really special for that reason as well. And in fact, that conductor skit that you mentioned earlier on, that has a lot of moments of Beethoven. You can't really tell it's Beethoven because I just used the orchestral crash, the A major, the bium at the start of Beethoven's seventh. It's also one that I've played, but that final movement, which I think we're going to hear, there's just so much gusto to it. It's just joyful. Again, it's one of those pieces of music that you cannot listen to and not smile.
Thank you.
Wagner wasn't wrong when he called that music the apotheosis of the dance.
Yeah, it really is phenomenal. I don't think that tempo actually does increase at the end, but it feels like it does. And I just feel that that's a real strength of that music. It's just pushing you further and further and further. And oh, just how that ends. I just can't get enough of that.
The fourth movement from Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Carlos Kleiber. Nick Mohammed, let's talk about the show that most people will probably know you for, Ted Lasso. For anyone who's not seen it, it's a comedy drama based around a football club, Richmond AFC, and an American, Ted Lasso, played by Jason Sudeikis. He comes to run the club, and his methods are not exactly conventional.
No, he doesn't have conventional methods at all. He comes from Kansas, and he's quite an eccentric, and he doesn't really know how football works or much about the Premier League, but he is just this joyful bundle of optimism and hope, and anyone who interacts with Ted ends up coming away a better person and feeling better about themselves. He's a real force for good, is Ted Lasso. And it has been, you know, that show has been an incredible force in my life. You know, I'm so grateful for it. I adored it.
And your character, Nate?
Yeah, well, Nate goes on a bit of a journey. He very much starts off as this lowly kit man. You know, he's quite insecure and lacks confidence, but through his interactions with Ted, kind of grows in confidence and is eventually made a coach. But then it all goes to his head and it takes actually a very dark turn, and he ends up leaving the club and becoming quite a toxic person, actually. And it really did trouble the fan base of the show a little bit that the character had done such a 180. But actually, it's about, I think, testing one's capacity for forgiveness. And it was a really lovely 3-season arc. And it's not often that you get, certainly in British telly, maybe you do get it more in American shows, because you're just not afforded the amount of time for supporting roles to kind of go on journeys. Often the supporting roles are there as a constant foil almost for your lead roles, which get to change and develop and so on. But it was just an absolute joy to be part of that team.
Nick Mohammed, the next piece, and actually it's another great dance score, was played at your wedding.
It was indeed. It's the Coda from Appalachian Spring, and both Becca and I love the Coda and love that very simple melody line. She studied music and she's a director of music at a school, and so a lot of her friends are quite muso, and so she put together just her mates, basically, like an 8-piece sort of male voice choir for the wedding, who have very kindly just agreed to sing. And a good friend of hers, who's a brilliant composer called Phil O'Mara, rewrote it for this male choir, and he took the words to, we're not overly religious, but we were getting married in a chapel because it was Christmas, and our religious reading was Corinthians 13, I think is the quite popular one. Anyway, he took that text, put it in Latin, and then put it to this tune. Yeah, so it's a really special piece for that reason as well.
Peaceful Coda from Appalachian Spring, performed by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Happy memories, Nick.
Just the most delicate ending of anything. I mean, you can hear a pin drop, right? That da, 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 da. I cannot get enough of that line. It's just beautiful.
Nick Mohammed, you've written, starred and produced your own sitcom called Intelligence. It's set in Government Communication Headquarters, GCHQ, in Cheltenham. How did you come to choose that as a location?
I really like the idea of this ragtag bunch of hapless individuals having this huge stakes of national security as a backdrop. The idea that you would trust these people with your lives and the things that they are doing to protect you, but they are just quite socially inept and they're quite silly and more concerned about what biscuits they might be having and whether the snack machine's been refilled. Of course, it's not an accurate representation of GCHQ, but it was a very silly show.
And did you base it on any of your own experiences?
A little bit. So when I had finished at Cambridge and then moved to London, I was gigging on a night doing comedy, but then I was working at Morgan Stanley, the bank, in the day. And I just managed a lot of the software and the systems that the traders would use. And I remember playing around with what I thought was the mirror server, sort of just testing some code. And I basically accidentally deleted a load of effectively what are sort of standing orders, but quite big trades that would automatically renew every day, deleting them willy-nilly, thinking it was just on a mirror server. And it turns out I was doing it for real. And I actually then put that in Intelligence, that my character had deleted some really important data, basically.
Funnily enough, you do play a hapless, distracted computer analyst called Joseph, a slightly irritating character. Do you like playing people with a bit of grit that rubs up against the norm?
I do, actually, yeah. I like the dance. I like the dance between charming and irritating, because you kind of can't fall too far into charming, because then there's no tension, there's no dramatic tension, and there's nothing that can create the comedy. There's nothing to sort of rub up against. But then you don't want to be so irritating that people turn off or can't stand you. You've got to give them enough of the charm. So it's the light and shade that I quite like in those creations and those characters.
And in a parallel to Ted Lasso, an American comes over to shake up the team, a man called Jerry, played by David Schwimmer. Mm. He's pretty offensive, isn't he? And I wonder whether you believe there's ever a line that shouldn't be crossed when it comes to comedy and causing possible offence.
Well, it's a really good question, and it's one that is increasingly relevant when everyone has a platform now on social media and so on. And, you know, look, everyone has a right to be offended. And in terms of where the line is drawn in comedy, that line is so blurred because it's transient. It depends on context. It depends on who you are. It depends on the timing of it. I wouldn't say I'm easily offended, but there would be things that I might find offensive that others don't. And we're probably equally valid for me to find it offensive and someone else not. And for all the noise on both sides of the argument, really, I don't know. For me, it just feels really obvious when a person, let's say a stand-up, is coming from a place of genuine insidious hate, or whether they are just making a joke and actually it's very much, look, we should all be able to laugh at each other. Can we just all lighten up a little bit? I think that that distinction, even though it's difficult to sort of precisely plot where that line is drawn, it always feels to me, oh yeah, no, they've overstepped the line because they are XYZ and they're talking down or they're batting down, and it's very clear that that is whipping up some kind of mob versus someone making a pun or kind of telling an anecdote that has a particularly edgy slash possibly gratuitous punchline. There are some jokes that I would never say, but that would be handled brilliantly in the hands of others.
Dvořák next.
Yes, The Noon Witch. And those tone poems are all extraordinary. And very briefly, The Noon Witch is about, it's a mum and a dad and a child. The dad is out at work in the field and the mum is sorting out the house and the child is misbehaving. And so the mum threatens the child and says, I'll call upon the Noonday Witch if you don't stop misbehaving. And the child kind of continues because he thinks it's just an idle threat. And the mum does call upon the Noonday Witch, who then appears trying to steal the child. The mum manages to fight the witch off. She takes her child and just holds the child just so closely and is just profusely apologising again and again. I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And the dad comes home from work but she has smothered the child so tightly that she's suffocated the child, so the child has died. So the Noon Witch has won, basically. I mean, it's obviously taken to extremes. I mean, it's a horrible story in a way, but it really packs a punch. And the ending, when you just get a flavour of the Noon Witch has actually managed to work their devilry, their magic, is so devastating as well.
The final part of The Noon Witch by Dvořák, performed by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, conducted by Nikolaus Harnoncourt. It has got a kind of whipping up of frenzy at the end, hasn't it?
You can hear every single moment of that story, from the moment that they realise what has happened to the witch sort of cackling from the beyond, and just that sheer realisation. It's a phenomenal piece of music.
Nick Mohammed, if listening to us today there is somebody who is in your position 20 years ago, what kind of advice would you give them?
The best answer I can give to that is realising that actually success, or any degree of success, is effectively founded on a series of progressive yet constructive failures. And that actually it's so easy, especially in this line of work, to beat oneself up. You know, if you have a bad gig, or your TV show doesn't get renewed, or your pilot doesn't get made, or you don't get that casting. It's so easy, I think, to sort of spiral a little bit. But actually, trying to sort of incrementally improve and trying to take the positive from every experience, accept the fact that it is part of the journey.
When I was a student, Nick, I met Shostakovich.
Wow.
And he said, "How's your composing going?" And I said, "I'm struggling." And he said, "Ah, oh, the struggle." Of course, he meant something completely different. He meant Stalin. Mm. But what he said was, "You must just keep writing." And I guess that's part of the advice you're giving too, isn't it? You just have to keep going.
Completely. And I think it's such a psychological barrier to almost even call yourself a writer or a composer, or, you know, anything that I guess you're kind of creating out of nothing. If you've got that drive, then that counts for a lot. Keep writing and keep at it. And of course, seizing every opportunity you can is also part of it.
That brings us quite nicely to your final choice.
Yeah, it's the final movement of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. And I mean, my goodness, yeah, you mentioned the struggle. I don't think either of us have experienced the struggle that those people would have experienced, you know, living under Stalin's reign. And I might misquote this, but I understand that the Fifth is labelled an artist's reaction to justified criticism or something like that.
Yeah,
an artist's response
just
to just criticism. His Fourth Symphony was not well regarded by Stalin at all and told him to write something else. So he set about obviously writing this Fifth Symphony. I interpret his Fifth Symphony as there are many sort of sardonic moments in this, and actually he is commenting on the political landscape, and none more so in that final movement when the violins are just playing a series of top A's again and again, na, 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 just again and again and again and again and again, to the point that it just becomes torturous and just seemingly never ending. And you just think that it surely can only be about the struggle and the oppression of the Russian people at that time. And, you know, obviously it bears a lot of relevance even today. And then, you know, it ends on that huge bass drum just pounding it out. And it's really, I mean, just all of Shostakovich's music is just so visceral, and there's a violence to it and an energy to it. He had a story to tell to Shostakovich, and he hid it in so many places in his music, and I just love it for that. But yeah, phenomenal piece of work.
Nick Mohammed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The fourth movement of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5 in D minor, performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andras Nelsons. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the comedian and writer Nick Mohammed. The programme was produced by Claire Walker.